But now this is the real humor, because we got Bob Mankoff on here. He is the he's a cartoonist for the New Yorker, which is like the highest form of life, as we know, possible in our current age. And but he's also the editor, so he decides who goes in there and all that stuff. And he's so and this he has a new book out based on his famous cartoon, probably his most famous cartoon, How About Never? Is Never Good For You? My Life in Cartoons, Bob Mankoff. He's on the here. And what is Briarcliff Manor, Bob?
Briarcliff Manor is a real estate name that is where I'm located, right next to Ossining, New York, which used to have, or maybe still has, Sing Sing prison. But I'm on the loose.
So it's really Sing Sing, New York.
Yeah. It's Sing Sing Manor.
Yeah.
So it's a very gated community.
How are you?
I'm doing great. I just heard the last part of your monologue. I want to just really congratulate you for trying to make people laugh at, what, 10 a.m. in the morning?
Yeah, or any time.
That's almost impossible. Or, I mean, it's 11 here. It's a little bit better, but, yeah. You know.
I find time of day doesn't matter for me so much.
Yeah.
It's irrelevant. So, you know, here's one thing I did want to ask you was this reference you have in the pop song. Or in a rap song. Do you know MC Paul Barman?
Oh, please, let's start with it.
The song, and this is the name of the song.
I know him. Somehow he ended up on my Wikipedia, mm-hmm. and among many obscene lyrics, he also states that he can draw better than me, and he might well be able to.
Well, yes.
Whoops. You can't say that on the radio. We'll return to more fun in just a moment.
And he's a Jewish rapper, so take that into account. And the rhyme was, she almost shrank off when I said, take your top tank off. I draw 1,000 times better than Robert Mankoff.
I think that's an exaggeration, 1,000, and that doesn't sound like a very good pickup line.
Yeah. Do you know this guy? Does he draw at all? Has he submitted cartoons?
He came in actually once to the magazine, as many people do every once in a while, because, you know, everybody, I'm sure, in your audience...
Everybody draws.
Everybody has an idea for a cartoon.
Yeah.
Many of them say, I can't draw.
Yeah.
I think maybe one of the most interesting incidents is that Norman Mailer called my... assistant, and he said, I'd like to come in and show Mr. Mankoff some cartoons. I said, I think he's got the wrong department, right? Like fiction or something? Yeah. But no, he comes in, and I said, Mr. Mailer, you draw cartoons? He said, not exactly. He was right. He had little sort of squiggle faces with sort of writing underneath. Later, he published them in a book called Modest Gifts, which was very aptly titled.
Yeah. Did he sell any of those? Probably not.
No, I think actually Vanity Fair published some of them.
Yeah,
so if
yeah.
you're really curious, David Mamet also has sent me cartoons. When I became cartoon editor, he sent me a note saying, congratulations, I'm sending you a batch of cartoons. I sent him back a note saying, thank you very much. I've taken the liberty of sending you a play.
That's pretty good.
But, thanks. I like the evaluation.
Yeah, no, that's pretty good. I wouldn't know what to say. I'd be too flabbergasted, you know, to say anything clever. Back to David Mamet.
Well, no. I mean, he just wrote a note. If he was there in the office, I'd be afraid of him.
Yeah, but Mailer, you put down in person, didn't you?
No, Mailer, but he's very old at the time.
Yeah, that'd be a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah,
actually.
You know, he was old. He was on crutches. I didn't think he could, like, you know.
Yeah.
Hit me with a left hook or something.
Yeah. It must be a living hell to be the editor for The New Yorker, the cartoon editor, because...
You know, I mean, the problem, as you pointed out, is there are conflicts because I'm the cartoon editor. I do the cartoons. I established this licensing company, the Cartoon Bank, which sells them.
Yeah.
So you might think between, you know, doing cartoons, selecting cartoons, there would be a conflict of interest, and I do, and I've established a Blue Ribbon Committee to investigate this, and it takes time. You know that, Michael.
Do you ever say to yourself, Mankoff, I don't think this one does it?
Yeah. But anyway, I'm heading that committee.
Yeah. Okay. You're heading. So, I'm sorry to step on that, Bob.
I'm sorry. That's okay.
Yeah. You never turned down a man cough.
Well, actually, a lot. David Remnick makes the ultimate decision on my cartoons, and and absolutely. Actually, I submit a lot less since I've become cartoon editor because, as I say in the book, we have a whole new bunch of people submitting cartoons, very good cartoons.
Yeah, oh, they're great. I mean, it's amazing. Your own style now. Where did you develop? Your line is like dots. And dashes. Dots and dashes.
It's called stippling, which sounds like a dermatological disease.
Yeah. Which it is also, I guess.
Which it is also. Yeah. That's right.
Did you always stipple? Did you always stipple from the beginning? Or?
Well, yeah. My mother took me to various physicians to try to cure me of it, but, you know. That was something. It's making these little dots, pointillism, like Surratt and stuff. I drew that way in the High School of Music and Art, or I made little pictures like that. And then originally I started because it was a little bit of a gimmick. I thought when you submit cartoons to magazines, when I did in the 70s, most of them is through the mail, and you want to be noticed, and I figured I would be noticed, and I got a note back from the New York Times once saying, we like your ideas, but could you try some less cumbersome style? And so that didn't work out, but it worked out for the New Yorker.
And have we
and
ever...
For interviews where people ask me about it.
Have we ever forgotten that comment from the New York Times? I bet we have not.
No, it's pasted. It's pasted in my scrapbook.
But it is kind of unique. So you started out with that line?
Well, I drew in a lot of different ways. Yeah. I was at the High School of Music and Art where just like Paul Barman, many people. It was one. There were three select schools in New York City you had to admit to. There was Brooklyn Tech, the Bronx High School of Science, and the High School of Music and Art, which is now, unfortunately, although he was a great mayor, called LaGuardia High School. I don't think it's as good a name. And to get in there, you had to like take tests and stuff. And once I got in there, I said, "Wow." All these people, or a lot of these people, can draw better than me. Fortunately now, sort of 50 years on, most of them became dentists or whatever. And my minor talent combined with some humor helped me.
Yeah, yeah. And that's really it, isn't it? I mean, the line, I mean, that makes it the cartoonist. It's not so much the joke, even, as much as a unique line. The New Yorker is just full of people with completely unique lines.
Well, it's sort of a voice, whether it's Roz Chast or going back to James Thurber or Charles Adams. And so, I mean, the interesting thing I think about the New Yorker cartoons is that, comedy now is a big business. And, you know, Jon Stewart is great, and he has 25 writers helping, you know, enhancing his talent. But with a New Yorker cartoon, whether it's Roz Chast or me or any of the 20 or 30 artists they have, you know, it's the whole deal. You write the line, you draw the picture, and, you know, maybe a Roz Chast cartoon, if we gave it to the whole staff of Jon Stewart, or maybe whoever writes for you, or maybe you, everyone could work on it, we could crowdsource it, and it'd be better, but it'd also be worse.
Yeah.
Because it wouldn't have that personality.
Yeah. But I mean the ink line, though.
Oh, well, the ink line is interesting because the ink line, there's a line in the caption, the concept.
Yeah,
but the concept,
I say. It's if you got the line, the drawing,
well,
the ink
just the line. Well, that's true, but and there's different types of lines, you know, realistic drawing for something that's really observational humor. But let's say there's humor that sort of that might cause some people in your sensitive audience, like, to go, ooh, like let's say this cartoon. It shows a gallows. And it shows steps to the gallows, but it also shows a ramp for the handicapped.
No. So it's accessible.
So you need that to be drawn sort of playfully.
Yeah, that's like that Native Americans one where the cowboy is inside his chuck wagon or whatever. All the arrows are flying, and he's yelling out, "Native Americans!" I thought that was along the same lines.
All of that because the New Yorker is a very sort of empathetic environment, and people are very, very sensitive. Like we get, you know, let's say we recently did a cartoon. And anyway, the annals of the offended are very, very long. I'll give you some examples. We did a cartoon recently where there's a woman talking to another woman, and she's saying, "I've only been gluten-free for a week, but I'm already annoying." and I'm just going to read you the email. "Shame on you people for publishing your cartoon. I've only been gluten-free for a week. I'm already annoying. For those of us with celiac disease, I find it very insensitive and offensive. Living this way is a necessity of life, not a fair diet. We live in a serious autoimmune disease. Try walking a mile in our shoes." And the last part, I actually take it, because the good thing about walking a mile in someone else's shoes is you're a mile away from them, and you have their shoes.
Is that what you said to her?
Yeah. But I'll give you another example of this, where there's a cartoon and it's lab guys and they're looking at a rodent inside, and the lab guy, and the rodent has hung himself. And the lab guy is saying, discouraging data on the antidepressant. and so I got letters, I don't like to see animals. So one of the letters, I don't like to see animals suffer, even in cartoons.
No.
And I wrote back, they don't suffer, we use anesthetic ink. And one of the things, people often misinterpret what's happening. The gluten-free cartoon is not about the people who actually have the disease.
No.
It's about everybody who thinks it. There wouldn't be a wall in the supermarket which had it. Anyway, people often, recently we did a cartoon in where it's Moses, he's parting the Red Sea, and there's a guy next to him with, you know, the metal detector that you use on the beach. Okay, so we get cartoons saying that I was shocked and outraged to see your latest issue depiction of Moses leading the Israelites to the parting sea. By showing this depiction, the New Yorker perpetuates a horrible stereotype about Jews.
Oh.
Anyway, so let's see. We decide. I'm Jewish.
Was it an obviously Jewish man who was?
No. First of all, Moses is just a mythological character.
Yeah.
The guy, it's just the conflation between the high and low. But let's see. David Remnick's Jewish, he decides. I'm Jewish, I decide. Harry Bliss, who drew the cartoon, is half Jewish, so I can only assume the part of him that isn't Jewish is anti-Semitic and did the cartoon.
Yeah. A self-hater.
You know,
my mom used to go. A self-hater.
That's how sensitive, you know, the people are to the stuff that appears in the New Yorker versus then at a comedy club or maybe even on your show.
Yeah. Or, for example, this is Lawrence. He does something with right-wing smearing. That's sort of...
Right. That's right. That's Bruce Eric Kaplan, who incidentally goes by the name B.E.K. And in my book, you know, there's this Seinfeld episode where Elaine doesn't understand the cartoon. And Bruce Eric Kaplan, B.E.K., who did the cartoon you just referenced, he wrote that, and I had just become cartoon editor, and I, you know, the fact that New Yorker cartoons are hard to understand, and I called him on the phone, and I said, "Et tu, Bruce?"
You're your biggest fan. That's what I like about you, Maureen.
Yeah, well,
but it's justified.
Why
at least
not?
In your...
Everyone else is sure to desert you.
Yeah. It's justified in your case. I like that. The guy who's carrying his baby into the office there says, "What do you think, boss? Adorable Dobson, but baby pictures will suffice from now on." So there's a mango.
And I did that cartoon when I had my daughter Sarah. That's
about. So all works in. Like walking into a bar and ordering Enfamil, meal, that sort of thing.
Are these your jokes or mine? I think they're mine.
That was yours. I'm not taking credit for any of this stuff.
Good, that's okay.
Yeah.
You use them anytime, just, you know, it's a licensing fee and we'll work it out.
Yeah. And you know what I like about your guys is that you can always see the texture on their suits and their pants. I always get the warp and the woof.
There's not many different clothing options in my artistic wardrobe.
They're always wearing something that looks pretty itchy.
Yeah.
But not as itchy as Ross.
But they don't suffer because, you know, it's anesthetic.
Yeah. Ross Chast, I think, is a lot itchier than you. I have to scratch. I mean, I love her stuff, but it also makes me itchy.
Well, Roz is, you know, this is, I mean, I think Roz's cartoons, you know, deal with, you know, some very, very deep humor. She has a book out, you know, Can We Talk About Something More Pleasant, which is about her aging parents and them dying. And I think, you know, there are various types of cartoons. Some of them are just jokes, you know, a knife with all corkscrews, and it's called, you know, French Army Knife. Mm. Okay. But a Roz cartoon, like one of them she did a number of years ago, was a guy looking at the obits, and all of the things say 3 years older than you, 2 years younger than you, your age right on the dot. So I think, so it, you know, it's varied. I mean, there's truth and there's just jokes.
Yeah. Is it impossible not to have favorites among your flock of cartoonists? I mean, I noticed you said Ziegler was one of your personal favorites.
Well, Jack Ziegler did that Gallows cartoons.
Yeah.
I have different cartoonists that I sort of, you know, admire for different things. Some of them are, you know, we you know, have a new cartoonist, Ed Speed, who was living in England. I moved to Taipei because he wanted to afford the cartoon, and we recently bought a cartoon of his in which there's people on the street, and they look like they're asking for money with a cup, but they're Red Cross people, and one woman is saying to the husband, don't give it to them, they'll only use it for drugs. So we have new cartoonists coming in, and when people say, you know, do you have a favorite joke, that sort of, or cartoon or whatever, that sort of implies there's a second favorite, a third, and a 48th.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't look at it that way. Also, I don't want to get in trouble.
Yeah. But you must be accosted everywhere you go, though. You're kind of like the food critic or something like that, who goes in, you know, everyone's going to try to please you or shove something that their cousin drew at you.
Well, yeah, and so, you know, and so you become sort of, you got to watch out that you don't become such a connoisseur of humor that you don't like anything.
Yeah.
And I think that, I think that's the nature of judgment. You know, when you're looking at the monologue that you're doing and you're writing the jokes or looking at the jokes, you're not laughing at them, I would hope. You're saying, ah, this works, that doesn't work. So there's a craftsman, you know, part of it, and, you know, it's a tough, dirty job, but someone has to do it. And and I've been on the other side a lot when, you know, I have that whole thing where I did about 2,000 cartoons before getting accepted to the New Yorker and suffered all that rejection. And the truth is, it's a lot easier rejecting than being rejected.
Yeah. I like this one. The other guy, the tombstone, says the other guy on it.
Yeah, that's a cartoon. That's a cartoon of mine, and that's part of the humor that you have. I have in the book about that I'm a hypochondriac because my mother, in the book, I say my mother lived to be 93, but she was in robust ill health her whole life. you know, always complaining, and I never I'd always ask my mom, I said, well, Mom, how are you feeling? And she'd say, not 100%. And so I said to her, what's the highest you ever reached? I want sort of a baseline to know, what it is. And so I sort of inherited, that thing and sort of a general anxiety that she had. And maybe actually is common, just to get a little bit ethnic, to Jewish humor about events and what might unfold. So many of Roz's cartoons, and, one of my cartoons, I don't think we should panic, but I think we should make preparations to that panic. And so that's, I think, what I'm doing most of the time.
Are there any guidelines at the New Yorker as to use of talking apartment animals?
Well, animals,
do you have a limit? Can you just submit one or two?
Everything talk. Well, yeah. At one time, Jim Garrity, who was the art editor and cartoon editor before Lee Lorenz, who was the one before me, got so tired of animal cartoons. Mm-hmm. And in 1959, it's some November issue, and you can actually look it up in the New Yorker archive, he only published animal cartoons in the magazine, and no one noticed. So I think one of the most famous animal cartoons goes back to 1993. It's Peter Steiner's cartoons. It's the two dogs in front of the computer saying, you know, on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. Of course, now everyone knows exactly what type of dog you are, the breed, your owner, and their criminal record.
But was it Thurber who started with the talking animals? Was he the initiator?
Well, originally his animals don't talk. We talk to them.
Okay.
It's really not until late. You know, there's a lot of animals. We talk about the animals and stuff, but they don't talk. But then, maybe in the 40s and 50s, that becomes sort of a comic trope. I mean, often the funniest ones are when we talk at them. There's a Leo Cullum cartoon where he's looking at the cat in front of the box, and he's saying, never ever think outside the box.
Yeah. That's a good one. I like that one. You don't do many talking animals, though, do you?
I can't because I have trouble drawing those animals.
Yeah. You can't stipple an animal? Can't stipple a cat?
Really, it's not. I think one of them I did where there's a cat talking to a bird in a tree. This is probably from the mid-90s, a little bird in a tree. And the cat is saying, let's do lunch.
Yeah. Well, that's cute. Is it hard to stipple something with fur? Because I would think that wouldn't be so hard.
Yeah, it is. You know, first stippling is some ascent of artistic, something that I still have to mount.
When you were a kid, a young person, did you want to be in Mad Magazine? Was that your first choice?
I wanted to be. I saw cartoons. Mad Magazine was a big influence, not the New Yorker. And although, you know, when I talk about it in the book, because I'm 70 now, and my joke about being 70 is the good news is 70 is the new 50. The bad news is dead isn't the new alive. So when I was growing up, there wasn't, you know, my parents had gone through the Depression, and my mom and dad were born in 1908. I remember when I decided, after sort of quitting graduate school in psychology, that I told my parents, for many reasons, I told them, well, you know, I'm going to be a cartoonist, because actually I did, going way back. My father looked at me rather sternly and said, you know, they already have people who do that. Like it was a civil service thing. But I did look at Mad Magazine and cartooning, and I did draw all the time, and it was sort of a natural fit for me to do, although I put it on hold during the 60s when I was avoiding the Vietnam War. But then, which is sort of interesting, when I became 30, it was sort of like I said, okay, I'm going to give it a shot. I did give it a shot, and it only took 2,000 rejections at the New Yorker before I became sort of an overnight success.
Did you have a fallback position, law school, medical school, accountancy?
Well, not really, because I was incompetent in everything else, which helped me. I really had worked for the welfare department and really almost becoming eligible myself. I did, amazingly enough, even though I'm slightly dyslexic, I taught speed reading at a Catholic school, girls' high school, by telling them to read faster or they'd burn in hell, which was sort of effective. So I really didn't have a fallback position. I mean, I had already failed on my fallback position.
Yeah.
And I think actually that was helpful. It was a certain, you know, desperation. Although I don't recommend it. Although sometimes when I go to school, because, you know, career days, and I find any kid in high school who wants to cartoon, I said, well, good news is you can quit school right now. And that's when they escort me out.
Yeah. Is there any resentment among the cartoonists for the filler in the New Yorker, the articles and reviews and such?
Well,
are there
two
camps? There must be.
Yeah, there's one camp, the writers, and David Remnick was a writer, and then we're at the children's table. We're at the children's camp.
Yeah, but everyone buys it and looks at the card. You know, they might article or two, but everyone.
No, they do. And I told, you know, the joke is 98% of the people say they read the cartoons first, and the other 2% lie. So I told David, to David Remnick, who's the editor, we could fit more cartoons in the magazine if we remove the articles.
Right.
But he's not for that. He's not for that. I don't think the cartoonists resented. Probably they're a little bit more, you know, for most of its history, the New Yorker had no illustrations, no artwork but the cartoons. It's only after really Tina Brown, or maybe it was Bob Gottlieb, shortly before Tina in the late 80s, early 90s, that photographs were included. And, you know, and now there are lots of photographs, and they do take up place. They could take we could have cartoons, and they're very nice, the photography department. But when I walked by, I said, you know, it's only a fad.
Yeah, passing. And there's still no color, though, right? I mean, color. If you use color, you're an illustrator.
There's color where you need it.
Yeah.
And you know, there's color, but not color. I mean, Howard Ross, when he asked why the cartoons weren't in color, he said, "What's so funny about red?" And I think to some extent that's true. You know, on the other hand, if you have a Jack Zeeler cartoon and it's sort of the day after Christmas, and you see a reindeer mounted on Santa's wall, and there's a little red nose that's red, you know, then it makes sense.
Yeah, that's the only time, though?
No, we have, you know, there's color when somehow the color is actually part, or is,
it's needed.
You know, makes the joke.
Yeah.
You know, so you might have a caption contest where there's a bull outside the window, and then there's cows inside who are domestic and anthropomorphized, but the curtains are red and the window has been broken. So you use red or blue or green or something when that's going to make sense and contribute to the joke.
Yeah. Do you have to, as the cartoonist, do you have to argue for its use? Do you have to make the case for use of color?
I have to argue for other things, but not really for its use. I mean, David Remnick has a great sense of humor, and he's by this time he's seen as many cartoons, because we get about 1,000 a week, and I show him about 50 a week as really anybody else but me.
Uh-huh. And what and as far as like the captions or the lines, what do you call them? You don't call them captions, do you? What do you call it? The line?
No, it's a caption.
It's a caption. Okay.
That's why we have a cartoon caption contest at the back of every issue.
By the way, I've finally given up on it because I submitted so many. But I had one.
Have you entered?
I have. Listen to this one now and tell me what happened here.
Okay. Okay.
There's these guys. They're in a wagon train going west, and you can see the Sierras in the background, and there are searchlights coming up from behind the mountains.
This is a Gay Ann Wilson cartoon, I remember.
Okay, and searchlights coming up there, and the one guy says to the other, in my version, there's Goldwyn and them thar hills.
You know, we made a mistake on that one, Michael.
I should have had it. I was so crushed. I thought, God, this has got to be, you know, it's probably what he had.
You could have been a contender.
At least one of the three
we put in there. We get 5 to 10,000.
I know.
Every week, so, and we look at all.
I know.
How many times have you entered?
I don't know. Maybe a dozen. I gave up. I was crushed.
Roger Ebert, the late Roger Ebert, won after 107 entries. You know what I mean? So really, you're a piker in terms of entries. I mean, Zach Galifianakis just entered twice, Maureen Dowd 3 times.
Yeah.
The people have entered, you know, hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And, I'm encouraging you and everyone in your audience.
Yeah. Well, which does come like when you're cartooning, do you get the line first, the idea first? Or you get a drawing. I mean, you don't do it like they do in the contest. You don't draw something and say, what would be a good caption for this? That's absurd.
I think sometimes you sort of fool around. I think sometimes just drawing itself, you're not drawing sort of at random,
right.
You know, and, you know, will stimulate, you know, your idea. I mean, you might be drawing, it might be a guy on a phone, and then you're just fooling around with different objects. I think one time I had a bald guy on a phone, and instead of the receiver, he had a comb, and he said, operator, get me my hair. So sometimes it's a combination, probably in something like, you know, the cartoon where it's like a completely verbal cartoon, like, no, Thursday's out, how about never is never good for you.
Yeah.
I was talking on the phone with someone who was actually blowing me off. So it's a combination. I would say you have really two types of cartoonists. One are the writers, caption firsters. You know, they just start writing quips, lines, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Then the other are the doodle firsters. They just start drawing. And one of the things to realize is that every cartoonist is doing 10 or 20 cartoons, rough drawings every week. So usually it's sort of a combination in the caption contest. And really, if you draw something, it's very unlikely, even if there's going to be something incongruous or weird, but you're going to feel there's going to be sort of an itch that, okay, there's an idea here. If you all of a sudden draw God, and you know, you can think, or Zeus, and you can think of the various things that could be a thunderbolt in his hand, but what happens if there was a tennis racket or a remote control? You're getting, you know what I mean? You're automatically not just picking random things where it's a nun, a bowling ball, in the Mormon tabernacle choir on a desert island.
Yeah. You tried all those, did you?
You can work on that. You can work on that.
But then there's a hyperspace where it actually becomes a New Yorker cartoon, right?
One of the things I'm grateful for in the cartoonist are the imprimatur of the New Yorker cartoon means something.
Mm-hmm.
Because it means that in this magazine, which in my opinion is the best magazine in the world, an amazing magazine, they think enough of humor not to isolate it on some page like The Light Side or something like that. But it's right there, you know, within the context of the series articles. And one of the things is where I think the New Yorker has a sense of humor, which means not just that you're funny or you write funny things, but that you poke fun of yourself. The cartoons sort of do that with the topics of the New Yorker, which is very empathetic, very liberal, believes in, you know, everything liberal and global warming and all of that. But you know, I did a cartoon that appears there where it's two women in a bar and one woman is saying to the other, I hate to admit it, but a man with a large carbon footprint makes me hot.
Yeah.
Or there's a,
now, who did you hear from on that one?
Well, not really. See, that's it. Didn't hear from her. I wasn't listening. Or just the general environmental approach of the New Yorker. There's a great Alex Gregory cartoon where there's two cavemen and one is saying, I don't understand it. The water is clean. The air is pure. Everything we eat is organic, but we only live to be 30. So I think there's a little subversive element, you know, that goes on that tweaks actually sort of the New Yorker pieties.
Yeah. But then again, you've gotten ripped off in your own magazine. Let Me Through, I'm the Victim, that famous cartoon.
Right. I did a cartoon where the guy's running late. But I'm not being ripped off. The people are submitting the cartoons because actually people come up with the same idea. They come up with...
After you've had it, though.
No, that doesn't get into the magazine. But they're, I mean, they'd be a little bit silly if my own cartoonist submitted to me knowingly a cartoon that I have done.
Homage. It's an homage.
Yeah. But so they just happen to come up with that idea.
Yeah. So those the other ones, the victim ones, didn't get in?
No, they didn't get in. I mean, one of the things is we have pretty strict fact-checking at the New Yorker, so that every cartoon that we buy at the meeting, so on Wednesday, David Remnick, I, and the managing editor, Sylvia Killingworth, we look at about 50. I've selected out of basically 500 from our own cartoonists, and total might be 1,000 that come in.
Wow.
Then after we select them, they get checked against all the 80,000 cartoons that have run in the magazine to make sure that there aren't duplicates. And now we also do internet searches as well. Mm-hmm. So we try not to repeat any idea. And sometimes we make a mistake, but we make a really good effort.
And always ask yourself, has Mankoff done this?
Right, absolutely. And then on the fact checkers, going back to your original talk about animal cartoons. In 1993, when Prozac was out, I had a little bluebird, and he had a vial of the pills, and then he's saying to the guy, hi, your guy, I'm the bluebird of Prozac in 93. So the fact checkers came and said, hey, this bluebird isn't drawn right. It's much too big. And I said, oh, yeah, I'm sorry, but I got to show the pills. So back and forth and back and forth, and then I had the fact checker, Dusty, come over and said, don't let this get out, but they can't talk.
There you go.
So it's that, you know, we want, if we're going to do a cartoon which has the Supreme Court, we're going to get the number of pillars right and stuff, but we have a lot of leeway on other things.
Well, and the book is called How About Never Is Never Good For You. That was a gift from God, right?
Well, absolutely. And now it's in the Yale Book of Quotations next to that other famous humorous Mao Zedong.
Yeah, right next to it. Bob, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
Bob Mankoff, ladies and gentlemen, How About Never Is Never Good For You.